Hello and welcome to The World Today. It's Wednesday, the 17th of April. I'm Sally Sara, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Today, Queensland's Olympic plans under scrutiny. A Senate inquiry investigates whether politics is getting in the way of progress. And a push to ban young people from smoking in the UK. Should Australia follow suit?
Personally, I think it's a very good piece of legislation, and you'll get that same answer from pretty much all of the other people who work in public health in the UK. Certainly a step in the right direction, which is most welcome.
Authorities are moving to crack down on social media accounts spreading misinformation in the wake of the stabbing attack at a church in southwestern Sydney on Monday night. It comes as Muslim community leaders express fears about retaliation at their places of worship. Alison Shaw reports.
A violent stabbing broadcast live. Members of the congregation say the video of Bishop Mari Emanuel being stabbed was shared widely, causing many to rush to the Christ the Good Shepherd Church in Wakeley.
We turned around and there were thousands of people and everyone was angry and we couldn't leave.
It led to chaotic scenes as unrest broke out and police were targeted.
I really don't think that the social media companies are doing as much as they ought to be to support the police in their efforts to keep calm in the community.
That's Federal Cabinet Minister Tanya Plibersek.
We know that there are people deliberately trying to stoke division on social media, deliberately lying to create that social division. Switch it off. If you can, switch it off.
The country's e-safety commissioner says she's not satisfied with the response from some social media companies and is exercising her powers under the Online Safety Act to formally compel companies like Meta and X to remove the video of the church attack.
Unexpected, gratuitous violence that could have a high impact on anyone who sees it. We worry about the radicalization and the normalization of that kind of behavior.
But it's not just graphic content authorities are worried about. The speed of the spread of false information is also of concern.
We're seeing a lot more abuse coming across on messaging platforms, a WhatsApp or Signal. So we're seeing a morphing and collapsing of what we might have considered social media, and it's getting more complex.
The Premier Chris Minns says the state government is working with Commonwealth authorities to target misinformation online and shut down some of the social media accounts that may have incited the violent scenes that unfolded on Monday night. He says in the wake of the attack, which police are treating as a terrorism incident, some people were rushing to mosques and churches on the hint or rumour that violent activity was taking place. Lebanese Muslim Association Secretary Jamel Keir describes how those threats unfolded.
There was numerous phone calls made to us on the social media that there was a threat to Lakemba Mosque and other mosques in Sydney. Thankfully, it didn't eventuate.
He says he's concerned about acts of retaliation directed at the Muslim community and raised questions over how quickly police decided to label the attack one of terrorism.
He used the language of religion. We're not debating that at all. It's clearly audible. And in a sense that it was targeted at another religion, that's not debatable. What's debatable was is what mental state was this child in? Surely there was time for the police to do a more thorough investigation and a review before they labelled it a terrorist act.
But the state's police commissioner, Karen Webb, is standing by her decision.
I was satisfied based on the information that was provided very early Tuesday morning that it met that criteria. The declaration of the incident being a terror event is one incident, but whether he's going to be charged with terrorism offences will be another. They are two separate things and they shouldn't be conflated.
An incident that's declared a terrorist act gives police more powers to investigate, like demanding people's identities or conducting stop and searches without a warrant. The commissioner says these powers will help investigators find out whether the 16-year-old alleged attacker was radicalised online. As the investigation continues, Faith Lee leaders are again calling for calm and unity. Murray Norman is CEO of Faith New South Wales.
This is a time that's very confusing. It's really important that families, faith communities, and leaders help people to process this. The faith community stands shoulder to shoulder with the government, with the police and with the Premier. We want to see New South Wales come out of this stronger. With the week we've had, it's horrific, but we need to stand together.
That's Murray Norman there, CEO of Faith New South Wales, ending that report from Alison Schau. And X and Meta have been contacted for comment. The United States will impose new sanctions on Iran as punishment for its weekend attack on Israel. The White House says it's planning sanctions which target Iran's missile and drone program and other entities which support Iran's military groups. President Biden has told Israel's leader Benjamin Netanyahu the US won't support any military response to the drone strike. But the Israeli War Cabinet is still weighing its options. Rachel Mealy reports.
It's been 3 days since more than 300 Iranian drones and missiles rained down on Israel. Iran says the attack was in response to a strike on its consulate in Syria. In a pre-recorded statement, Israel's top general, Herzi Halevi, gave the clearest indication yet that Israel will respond militarily, despite fears it could trigger a regional war.
Iran's attack has created new opportunities for cooperation in the Middle East. We are closely assessing the situation. We remain at our highest level of readiness. Iran will face the consequences for its actions. We will choose our response accordingly.
It prompted this response from Ali Bagheri Khani, Iran's deputy foreign minister.
If for any reason the Zionist regime makes the slightest malevolent move against our homeland, our people, or our interests, it will definitely face a resolute and hard response.
In a bid to head off a military escalation, the foreign ministers of Britain and Germany are heading to Israel to push for a diplomatic response. But Israel's war cabinet continues to look at all options. Israel's Defence Force spokesman, Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner, says the IDF has prepared options for a military strike back.
Our role in this, the military, is to prepare the spectrum of opportunities, and the government will decide what needs to be done.
The US is working to dissuade Israel from taking a military response and says it wouldn't come to Israel's aid if it were to do so. Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner says ultimately the response is Israel's decision.
We are very grateful for the international alliance, an alliance of decent nations that came together to defend Israel on Saturday. Under the umbrella of the United States Central Command, together with the United Kingdom and France and regional nations. So, of course, the government will be listening, and we are continuing to have our deliberations with the U.S. Military from military to military perspective. We are very attentive to our allies and, as I said, very grateful.
Professor Sharam Akhbazadeh is the convener of the Middle East Studies Forum at Deakin University. He says the announcement of US sanctions will have little real impact, but will make Iran feel further isolated.
When Israel attacked the Iranian consulate in Damascus, the international community, the United Nations Security Council, was effectively stopped from making a condemnation, a declaration on that point and condemning Israel, because the US did not want to allow that to happen. So this really reinforces the Iranian narrative that Iran is putting up a fight against imperial power.
Professor Akhbazadeh says the final decision rests with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, regardless of what his war cabinet decides.
I think the decision and power really sits in Netanyahu's office. He has his own agenda and his own concerns. He has a very right-wing government, coalition government, and he is beholden to the right-wing government, to the right-wing faction in his government. Also, he has his own criminal charges to worry about, and losing office would potentially mean heading to prison. So there are a number of factors that are in play for Netanyahu.
That's Professor Sharam Akhbazadeh from Deakin University, ending that report from Rachel Mealy. Right around Australia, you're tuned into The World Today. Olympic veteran John Coates insists that work is progressing on Brisbane's 2032 Olympic Games, but admits that political considerations are having an impact on the rollout. Mr. Coates has been quizzed during a Senate inquiry investigating preparations for the Olympics. He says he's relaxed about the progress so far, despite no date on when construction will start, as Stephanie Smale reports.
John Coates' list of Olympic credentials is long, including decades at the helm of the Australian Olympic Committee. He initially declined to appear before a Senate committee investigating how preparations are unfolding for Brisbane's 2032 Olympic Games, but changed his mind. In Brisbane today, National Senator Bridget McKenzie quizzed him on the to-ing and fro-ing about which stadiums will or won't be built and whether the delays are a concern.
Right now, we have no agreed position on facilities, transport infrastructure projects to get volunteers, athletes and officials and spectators safely to and from these great events, and nor do we have funding arrangements in place.
I think the concerns you raised are real, but the concerns need to be directed to the Queensland Government.
John Coates has confirmed he was in talks with the Queensland Government about his pick of stadiums at the same time as an independent review was being carried out by Brisbane's former Lord Mayor Graham Quirk, which the state government then ignored. Liberal Senator and former Sports Minister Richard Colbeck also asked if he was worried about delays, but John Coates says he's not stressing.
There would have to be a level of frustration that we're still dealing with some of the foundation issues that we should have moved on from now. You know, it's about time we just got on with it. Fair assessment of where we sit today?
Fair but not damaging. In my experience in other games, which were only awarded 6 or 7 years out, my experience from Sydney, where there was no master plan until 1995, one was put together, I'm quite relaxed about where we're at.
Brisbane's former Liberal National Party Lord Mayor Graham Quirk also fronted the inquiry, telling the committee short-term political considerations are muddying the rollout of the 2032 Olympics. After his review, Graham Quirk recommended a brand new stadium be built at Victoria Park near Brisbane's CBD. He's told National Senator Matt Canavan the political climate is having an impact.
Do you think the decisions being made right now about Olympic venues are being more driven by the upcoming October state election rather than the Brisbane Olympics in 2032?
There is perhaps a fear that by building a new stadium it will be seen as extravagance during a period where families are doing it tough. But I would say this, that even during the Great Depression, people were looking for hope. They had a racehorse called Farlap in the day, which was their great hope. People need to know that there is something coming in this city to be proud of.
Queensland's Premier Stephen Miles says he can't justify the cost of an expensive new stadium when voters are doing it tough. But Graham Quirk argues it's likely the cost of renovating existing stadiums won't be much cheaper. He's told the committee it's worth continuing investigations into the brand new stadium with a so-called project validation report in case the state government changes in October.
The cost of a Gabba upgrade, cost of a Suncorp upgrade, I think you're going to find that those costs collectively will be greater than the cost of a new stadium at the site proposed.
The hearings continue.
That's Stephanie Smale reporting. The federal government has announced hundreds of millions of dollars in loans for critical minerals projects. The funding will go to a high-purity alumina processing facility in Queensland and a graphite venture in South Australia. It's part of the government's Future Made in Australia Act to support high-tech industries. But does Australia still have a lot of work to do to catch up with other critical mineral nations in a highly volatile market? Susan Park is Professor of Global Governance at the University of Sydney.
It certainly does. If you look at the position that we're in, we're very, very lucky in terms of having a high or moderate geological content for up to 26 critical minerals. So we do really well in terms of what we naturally have. But in terms of the gains that we are receiving from those minerals is purely as an export of a raw material. So a vast majority of the minerals that we have, we export to other countries like China for processing.
Why are critical minerals so critical?
It's a really important question, actually, because what we know is that we have to urgently transition to renewable energy. That's one of the primary ways through which we can reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. And so the issue for us is how we do that fast. And the best way to do that is through renewable energy. And so the question is, well, why do we need so many minerals? It's because the future will be much more mineral intensive. If you think about an electric vehicle, you need many, many more minerals to create an electric vehicle battery than you do if you're just burning fossil fuel. So we're looking at a future where there is a huge demand for all of these critical minerals, from cobalt through to lithium through to rare earths.
Which countries are our biggest competitors? We often see China and Canada mentioned, and we also know that some of these critical minerals come out of Africa as well. Is that right?
Absolutely. So you can identify, according to the mineral, where Australia sits. So, for example, we are the world's largest exporter of lithium in the world. But we're second in terms of rare earth elements. And this is just really to give us a sense of what the geological content is, like how much we can get out of the ground. So China dominates rare earth elements in terms of export, but also for processing, and that's where we fall down. We are not even on the map in terms of what we process.
What are the forecasts telling us about how much growth, how much exponential growth is expected in the critical mineral markets around the world?
So we've seen a range of different forecasts, and they change pretty rapidly based on what we know about the different market actors and the demands that are required. The World Bank, for example, has envisaged, you know, up to 200% or 400% increase of different minerals depending on the forecasts, and that obviously plays into the speed of which renewable energy is being taken up around the world. So it's predicated upon what we're doing now, but obviously the state of the world, right? So the extent to which there is continued economic growth, and that is being fueled by the demand for renewable energy.
How different is this industry compared to things like iron ore, where we're taking out huge quantities and exporting? How much smaller and more specialised are these kinds of critical minerals in their extraction and processing?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think lithium, for example, is one area where we dominate. We have the world's largest lithium mine, Greenbushes, in Western Australia. Lithium, for example, has a huge boom and bust cycle. And I think there is a lot of eagerness in the market, and sometimes that becomes overblown, and then there's oversupply. So the market can be really quite volatile.
That's Susan Park there, Professor of Global Governance at the University of Sydney. The COVID vaccine rollout was one of the dominant features of 2021. Now, new research calculates just how many deaths it prevented. Researchers say data from New South Wales shows the vaccine campaign saved almost 18,000 lives in the over 50 age group in less than a year. Alexandra Humphreys reports.
As long lockdowns kept people in Australia's largest cities away from their families and friends throughout much of 2021, attention turned to COVID vaccinations as a way out. We wanted to know when we could get them, how many we would need, and how safe they were.
Let's do this, New South Wales, because we're over this and this. This is our chance to play on. Keep the lights on.
Advertising campaigns like this one dominated the airwaves as authorities raced to reduce the number of COVID-related deaths. Now, a study from researchers at RMIT and Monash University has put figures around how many lives the vaccine saved. It's estimated for people aged over 50, almost 18,000 deaths were prevented in New South Wales alone between August 2021 and July the following year.
We've known these vaccines have made a tremendous difference, but often it's hard to appreciate just how big that difference is.
Paul Griffin is an infectious diseases physician and clinical microbiologist and has served on advisory boards for COVID-19 vaccine companies.
For people that had the primary vaccination course, their chance of dying was reduced to nearly 8 times. And for people that had the booster, that was reduced even further to over 11-fold. So it shows just how big the impact was on reducing the chance of dying had you been vaccinated.
The researchers were unable to access full Australian government data sets, so focused their work on New South Wales. Despite that, the researchers believe their findings reflect the national experience.
Every state essentially had a different experience with COVID, so it wouldn't have been identical perhaps, but in terms of the benefits of vaccination, that's likely to have been quite similar in the different states.
Professor Tony Blakely is an epidemiologist from the University of Melbourne. He believes it's possible to extrapolate from the study that about 45 or 50,000 deaths were likely prevented across Australia.
This just shows you that with the benefit of hindsight, the elimination strategy was the winning strategy for a country like Australia. It gave us time to get the population vaccinated. We also had luck in that the virus that was circulating when we did open up was Omicron, and that was less likely to kill you or put you in hospital than some of the pre-Omicron variants.
The study finds Australia's vaccination campaign successfully reduced mortality throughout 2022. That was largely because people were highly engaged with the campaign and high levels of coverage were reached shortly before the major Omicron outbreak.
And we see this in both Australia and New Zealand, that both countries rallied together and acted as a team to get through the elimination part, deal with keeping the virus out, then get vaccinated. That was a great team effort. Because the vaccines waned quite a lot in their protection, we were a little bit lucky in that we got a lot of our population vaccinated within the sort of 3 to 6 months before we opened up. So that was good in retrospect. And then we were able to boost the population. So things went pretty well for us, but you make your own luck.
That's epidemiologist Professor Tony Blakely there, ending that report from Alexandra Humphreys. The UK House of Commons has passed a bill that will ban smoking for anyone born after 2009. The progressive ban means that current smokers will still be able to light up until the day they die, but anyone currently aged under 15 will never be able to buy a cigarette in the UK. It's similar to a brief ban in New Zealand, which was scrapped. Angus Randall reports.
So the eyes have it, the eyes have it.
Despite dozens of his own party members voting against it, UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak passes a bill through the House of Commons to create some of the world's strictest anti-smoking rules. The bill will now head to the House of Lords, where it's also expected to pass. In London, locals are preparing for a smoke-free future.
If I hadn't picked up my first cigarette, I wouldn't be a smoker now.
Might as well make it a smoke-free Britain.
If you've got parents who don't mind their kids smoking, then they're going to buy it for their kids.
Wish I wasn't addicted to this.
The ban will not impact the 6.4 million Britons who currently smoke. Under the legislation, the legal smoking age will continue rising year by year, so it should be phased out in a lifetime. Dr. Robert Branston is from the University of Bath in the UK and a part of the country's Tobacco Control Research Group.
So at the moment in the UK, you have to be 18 years or older to buy tobacco products in the shop. And the idea of the UK government is that they will slowly increase that age so that anyone born from 2009 onwards will never legally be able to buy tobacco products in the shop.
There were some high-profile critics of the proposed ban. Former Prime Minister Boris Johnson said it was absolutely nuts, and fellow former PM Liz Truss says the government can't protect adults from themselves. Dr. Branston says much of the pushback is for show.
Firstly, there are a number of individuals on the sort of right wing of the governing Conservative Party who are what you might call libertarian, who believe people should be free to make poor choices if they so wish. And then you also have a number of other people who are voting with them because they want to be seen to be of that ilk.
In Australia, such a move would be a decision for the states, but any push to ban smoking has never made it to a vote. A private members' bill in Tasmania in 2014 fell through. Dr. Catherine Barnsley is from Smoke Free Tasmania.
Certainly in Tasmania, for 10 years, we've been working towards that same legislation that is a birth date phase out of tobacco products. None of the other states have shown much interest. Occasionally that it's mentioned in Queensland and West Australia, but then it seems to disappear off the radar again.
A similar smoking ban was brought in a few years ago in New Zealand, but it was reversed by the current government soon after they came to power. That's part of the challenge. It only works if all future governments stay the course.
In the case of the New Zealand situation, it was a Conservative government that came in and repealed it. But the difference is in the UK situation, you've got a Conservative government bringing it in. So it seems to me unlikely that a Labor government, if it were elected, would repeal it.
The UK bill could become law before the general election, expected in the second half of the year.
Angus Randall. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Sally Sara.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. It's been an unsettling few days with two major knife crimes in Sydney. So what's going on? Today, an extremism expert on what we know about the latest attack on a church in Sydney's west and the importance of social cohesion in tense times. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.